So I wanted to talk today about the idea of communal luxury and contemporary Australian poetry. In light of widespread environmental and cultural loss and the ever-increasing precarity of life, we need to rethink not only the relationship between word and act, but also the possibilities of a communal imaginary in negotiating the contemporary and its future directions. I want to springboard from the thinking behind the Paris Commune, specifically from Poitier's now famous declaration within its manifesto, "We will work cooperatively towards our regeneration, the birth of communal luxury, future splendours and the universal republic." With one eye on the relationship between reproducing and transforming the social, the other was focused on the need to integrate aesthetics and everyday life. What role might poetry have in not so much enabling another life, to quote Rancière, or, as Robert Duncan also put it, news of an other life, but to enable what Keats called the distinctness of luxury in lives that are otherwise materially and socially limited and constrained. So this paper considers how contemporary Australian poetry explores what communal luxury might mean in the 21st century, and how it might be both geopolitically specific and internationalist in coalition. Back in the 19th century, Emily Dickinson declared, wild nights, were I with thee, wild nights should be our luxury. Her poem reminds us that being able to act upon one's sexuality was a luxury, in particular historical and cultural contexts. Importantly, Dickinson uses a collective pronoun, our luxury, gesturing towards shared experience or commons. Today, the basics to human life that are increasingly spoken about as a luxury include not only education, but recognition as a subject, the availability to cross public and national spaces, a home, and even access to non-toxic water and air. Italian Marxist feminist Silvia Federici suggests that there must be a quality of relationality, which includes a principle of cooperation and of responsibility to each other and to the earth, forests, seas, and animals. She discerns, most importantly, we cannot build an alternative society and a strong self-reproducing movement unless we put an end to the separation between the personal and the political, and between political activism and the reproduction of everyday life. Federici notes how women in both Chile after the 1973 US-led coup and in Bolivia, Peru and Argentina in the 1990s came together to respond to rising poverty and extreme political and economic repression under globalised neoliberalism. They created collective food kitchens, shopping committees, committees to guarantee minimal food for children, all of which sometimes meant the difference between life and death. Through generating solidarity, these women began to transform social relations, not only by sharing and transcending their pain and isolation, but also by pooling and producing knowledge, empowering themselves and their communities in the process. Moreover, in sharing resources and building collective power, these women also often shielded themselves from patriarchal abuse on the part of husbands or brothers. While Federici focuses attention on material labour and the role on material labour, the communards recognise the significance of immaterial labour alongside material labour and the role of poetry in the process of making or regenerating. One of Australia's most activist poets was Lesbia Harford. One of the first women to obtain a law degree at the turn of the 20th century, she spent most of her life working in factories or as a servant, was a member of the Industrial Workers of the World and a leading figure in the clothing trades union. Harford would write of the relationship between desire and need under capitalism. "I want this thing and that, a pudding bowl, a saucepan and a hat for Pat." And of the difficulty of finding time for rhyme, as she put it. But whereas dreams were quickly deeds when she had more leisure, words became even more crucial for a sense of self beyond instrumentality. To words, she notes, "I fall at last." So words offset the toil and struggle in her life. Another of Harford's poems finds pleasure in a fellow worker's red tape measure. The tape measure transforming from object of use and authority, thinking here of how the tape measure is a means to quantify or cut up space into unit, to the luxury of passion. Here, same-sex desire and a symbol of revolution. Natalie's poem, Justice. In her recent poem, Justice, Natalie Harkin draws attention to the removal of basic rights and freedom across time and culture and the role of aesthetics in generating solidarity. Citing the forced labour of her Aboriginal ancestors, deaths in custody, the detention of asylum seeker children, and violence targeted towards women, non-heteronormative people, and the Indigenous, her poem is a ritualistic invocation to justice that makes links between those Australians denied human basics, but also Canadians denied human basics. Moreover, she also draws attention to North American Indigenous activist Josephine Mandeman, whose water walks drew attention to issues of water access and exploitation, and who was mobilised by the prophecy that by 2030, an ounce of water will cost the same as an ounce of gold. Harkin notes the significance of the relationship between aesthetics and life, speaking of the beauty of the Samarkand water walkers, the healing art of the victim of a hate crime, the music of a victim of speed, and the poetry of those who have died in police custody. Her use of an almost prayer-like structural form partakes in a shared voice, we, and actively enlivens memory through a performative repetition of form and phrases. We will honour you. In this sense, Harkin mobilised traditional aspects of mythos associated with the mode of poetry. The poem itself is a communal space by making the reader become a part of the we and writing imperatives in the present and future tense. We choose, we carry, and we will. The poem is serial but does not synthesise in its naming of injustice. The many spaces in lines within the poem moves it away from traditional verse or prayer, drawing attention to erasures or non-recognition in both history and rhetoric. This is reinforced by Harkin not naming individuals, a reminder that those without basic human rights are typically rendered nameless. So the poem's shifting constantly between presence and absence, loss and retrieval. While Harkin generates a coalition... Can you find Michael's hybrid poem? While Harkin generates a coalition between Australian and Canadian sites of activism, Michael Farrell considers not so much coalition between human and non-human in a lyrebird, but what might perhaps best be thought of as transcorporeality. The speaker both assumes the voice of the lyrebird, I tip my beak to the sky, while also possibly being the human watching it. Swift-footed, it stops behind a mountain ash. Or at least Farrell confuses the perceptual distinction. The poem foregrounds the impact of human expansion on other species. A nest-building lament starts up, it's humans taking up too much room. Farrell suggests that the problems are as much epistemological as material, with the moaning sore being inside a person's mind. Following the work of Stacey Alamo, a lyrebird is not an elegiac eco-poetics, mourning a static, pure past, but rather speculative on how ecologies are themselves dynamic, incorporating the unwanted actions of humans. Here, the wreck of a rolled car becomes a nest. The function of a car changes, and it is projectile again in a different sense, such that maybe cars could learn ethics through becoming nests. Farrell suggests that the environment also informs and shapes the materiality of language, and that this too challenges a human-dominant power dynamic assumed by the lyric, somehow we're used by the earth's language. Now, A Lyrebird is a revision and transposition of Keats's poem Endymion, with Keats's bower quiet being the bower of the Australian lyrebird. Like the wreck of the car in the forest, Farrell looks at how European tradition might be renovated, how its poetic forms and language might be materials to build a new nest or web upon. Following Keats, Farrell embraces the luxury of the open imagination, aligning an enclosed imagination with violence. To quote, the enclosed imagination buys a hunting gun. For Farrell, the didactic poem, one that sets out right and wrong, is equally problematic. A rhyme's a moral that becomes a fence. Rather, the imagination should be free to range. Farrell, misquoting Keats's "A thing of beauty is a joy forever," as "a fallen down fence is a joy forever." And this might be an axiom of decolonisation too. Keats himself wrote to his friend Reynolds against the enclosure of habit. "Many are led away by custom. Not, it appears to me, almost any man may like the spider spin from his own inwards, his own airy citadel. The points of leaves and twigs on which the spider brings her work are few, and she fills the air with a beautiful circuiting. Men should be content with as few points to tip with the fine web of his soul, and weave a tapestry empyrean, full of symbols for his spiritual eye, of softness for his spiritual touch, of space for his wandering, of distinctness for his luxury." Like Farrell, Keats wants to have space for wandering. Writing or thinking poetically is a form of industry, immaterial labour, but one in which there's a different economy of consumption. To quote Farrell, "history mistakes swallowed up in a nominal grub," with Farrell using the Australian colloquialism of grub for food. In breaking down poetic fences, all genres are destroyed at last. Farrell borrows into and links up with Keats's free-ranging of the imagination, viewing, as Emily Dickinson before him, Keats's company or kin, creating, invoking through repetition, a poetic circuiting or networking of influence. Like Natalie Harkin, Michael Farrell uses repetition strategically, lyrically enacting a cyclic return of lines. They're using repetition in quite different ways. But with each of Farrell's repetition, there is a difference, the difference being wrought contextually, there being a kind of joy in the poetic process. And I think this is quite important, that in the face of loss or destruction, affective registers other than grief and anger, although these are important too, might be navigated through poetry. In Lorca in the Outback, can we get to... Michael again, Lorca in the Outback. Farrell imagines the Paris Commune referred to as a local movement, an outback community's in feverous aesthetic revolution. They're always writing poems about the hot snows of suffering, or odes to roosters. There is a sense of excess in the absurd in this, both in the hot snows and in the odes to roosters, which extends to Lorca's play The House of Bernarda Alba, about women in the villages of Spain, becoming a runaway cult that spreads even across state borders. The poem relies in part on a camp recognition of what is out of place in such a setting. The poem stages what Steve Collis calls the impossible totality of change. It's a kind of Keatsian fancy or frolic that foregrounds the blurring of fiction and reality, politics and entertainment in the contemporary era, how the revolutionary ideals of European movements are always already mediated, and a historical figure like Lorca might be as much a character or type as Hamlet. While Lorca's play heavy-handedly critiques gendered oppression, Farrell subverts its tone. There was much wearing of black or green with straws, of stylized, repressive and rebellious gesture, but mercifully no shooting. Farrell contemplates it becoming so popular that the whole male population of a town in New South Wales dons Southern European mourning drag in order to not be left out. In queering the revolutionary text, Farrell questions who or what forms of resistance are possible, while saying it could be just a living analogy, a Kleinemann in attempts at Indigenous and European reconciling, the limits of such an exercise become apparent. Could there be such a thing as a shared sacred place where Australian space accommodates the many graves of Lorca? To what extent does political aesthetics as communal luxury become emptied of meaning or simply fashionable? I want to finish up today on a little bit of a tangent by moving from the poem to collective poetic practice in thinking about communal luxury and how contemporary poetry needs to shift beyond a capitalist ideology of competitive individualism that is undergirded through a system of grants, prizes and awards, to note the precariousness of the lives of poets who often turn to the academy for economic support. So thinking about the context of this conference today. And to think, though, too, of how humanities within the university is increasingly precarious and subject to institutional reductions in rhetoric, recognition and funding. In an era where labour is increasingly quantified by the hour, where the differences between types of work, those doing cognitive work or immaterial labour versus those doing manual work, is often based on first world and third world distinctions, and where the gap between those who work and those looking for work is growing ever wider, poetry sometimes seems like a luxury or folly, a Keatsian act of indolence. In a period in what we are seeing the very nature of human basics become luxuries, we need to keep questioning, and I think poetry does this, what life constitutes and how language, its form, its sensuousness and the possibilities of joy and beauty might be communally available. Thanks.